Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So this is February 8th, 2012 in Radhadesh, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 9, The Supreme Character of Jada Bharat, Text 18. So this is a text for all of you who like ghastly, horrible, fighting stuff. If you don't like that, you probably shouldn't listen to this verse. Brisham Amarsha Roshavesha Rabhasa Vilasita Brukuti Vitapa Kutila Damstra Une Kshana Topati Bhyayanaka Vadana Hantu Kame Vedam Mahatahasham Ati Samrambena Vimunshati Tata Utpatya Papiyasam Dushtanam Te vai vasina vivrikna shirshnam galat shravantam ashrig asavam atyushnam sahaganena nipiyati pana mada virhalochai stranam sva parshadai saha jagau nanarta cha vijahara cha Shira Kanduka Lilaya. So this is going to be a strange Lilaya. Shira Kanduka Lilaya. Shira means, anybody know what Shira means? Head. Kanduka means balls. So they're going to play a new sport, which we don't suggest becomes part of the international competition. Okay, going through the word for word. Brisham, very highly. Amarsha, in intolerance of the offenses. Rosha, in anger. Avesha, of her absorption. Rabhasa Vilasita, expanded by the force. Brukuti, of her eyebrows. Vitapa, the branches. Kutila, curved. Damstra, teeth. Aruna Ikshana, of reddish eyes. Actually, Aruna literally means the sunrise. Atopa, by the agitation. Ati, very much. Bayaknaka, fearful. Vadana, having a face. Hantukama, desirous to destroy. Eva, as if. Idam, this universe. Maha Attahasam, a greatly fearful laugh. Ati, great. Samrambena, because of anger. Vimunchanti, releasing. Tataha, from that altar. Utpatya, coming forth. Papiyasam, of all the sinful. Dushtanam, great offenders. Tena eva asina, by that same chopper. Vivriknya, separated. Shirshnam, whose heads. Galat, from the neck. Shravantam, oozing out. Asrik asavam, the blood compared to an intoxicating beverage. Atiushnam, very hot. Saha, with. Ganena, her associates. Nipiya, drinking. Atipana, from drinking so much. Mada, by intoxication. Vivala, overwhelmed. Uchaitaram, very loudly. Swaparshadai, her own associates. Saha, with. Jagau, sang. Nanarta, danced. Cha, also. Vidjahara, played. Cha, also. Shirakanduka, using the heads as balls. Lilaya, by sports. So again, this is for all of you who like horror movies and things like that. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. So you all know what's going on here, right? We had a little break. We had a thematic class and this special day and that special day. So remember that where Jed Bharat is, right? Where is he? He's in whose temple? Kali's temple. Right? Did any of you see the drama that we did in Mayapur on this pastime? Anybody see that? No? You saw it. Okay. Good. So we had the scene there. We had two ladies. Actually, Tulsi, who was just here, was the back arms. So we had two ladies, with their arms. And all the dacoits were saying, Kali, Kali, Bhadra, Kali, 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 Bhadra, Kali. And then this happened. Although not, we did it symbolically. Translation. Intolerant of the offenses committed, the infuriated goddess Kali flashed her eyes and displayed her fierce curved teeth. Her reddish eyes glowed, and she displayed her fearsome features. She assumed a frightening body, as if she were prepared to destroy the entire creation. Leaping violently from the altar, she immediately decapitated, that means take the heads off, all the rogues and thieves with the very sword with which they had intended to kill Jada Bharat. She then began to drink the hot blood that flowed from the necks of the beheaded rogues and thieves as if this blood were liquor. Indeed, she drank this intoxicant with her associates, who were witches and female demons. Becoming intoxicated with this blood, they all began to sing very loudly. I'm sure you've all seen intoxicated people, and they start singing very loudly. When we lived in New York, a couple blocks from the temple, when we'd walk to Mangalarti, it's the only time that the city would be mostly sleeping. And the only people out on the streets were like the ladies of the night going home and the drunks going home. And they'd often be singing very loudly on the street, not usually very pleasantly, but very loudly. So they all began to sing very loudly and dance as though prepared to annihilate the entire universe. At the same time, they began to play with the heads of the rogues and thieves, tossing them about as if they were balls. So they were having a sport, throwing these blood-dripping heads around and drinking the blood out of the necks of the thieves and dancing and singing. After a very violent jumping from the altar. All right, purport. It is evident from this verse that the devotees of goddess Kali are not at all favored by her. So this is what you get for worshiping Kali. It is goddess Kali's work to kill and punish the demons. Goddess Kali, Durga, engages in decapitating many demons, dacoits, and other unwanted elements in society. Neglecting Krishna consciousness, foolish people try to satisfy the goddess by offering her many abominable things. But ultimately, when there is a little discrepancy in this worship, the goddess punishes the worshiper by taking his life. Demoniac people worship goddess Kali to obtain some material benefit, but they are not excused of the sins performed in the name of worship. To sacrifice a man or animal before the deity is specifically forbidden. Intolerant of the offenses committed, the infuriated goddess Kali flashed her eyes and displayed her fierce curved teeth. Her reddish eyes glowed and she displayed her fearsome features. She assumed a frightening body as if she were prepared to destroy the entire creation. Leaping violently from the altar, she immediately decapitated all the rogues and thieves with the very sword with which they had intended to kill Jetabharat. She then began to drink the hot blood that flowed from the necks of the beheaded rogues and thieves as if this blood were liquor. Indeed, she drank this intoxicant with her associates, who were witches and female demons. Becoming intoxicated with this blood, they all began to sing very loudly and dance, as though prepared to annihilate the entire universe. At the same time, they began to play with the heads of the rogues and thieves, tossing them about as if they were balls. So Prabhupada explains that whatever we do anywhere, material world, spiritual world, we do because there's some taste, there's some pleasure, there's some rasa. Rasa means a taste. And there are 12 rasas. And Prabhupada said there's nothing else other than these 12 rasas anywhere. That everything can be explained in terms of these 12 rasas. So we know the primary rasas are neutrality, right? Servitorship, friendship, parental, and conjugal love. But Prabhupada says that sometimes when the primary ones are absent, so the secondary ones may be present. And the secondary ones are anger, wonder or awe, comedy, chivalry, mercy, horror, and shock. So here we see some shock and horror and anger. And the secondary rasas, Prabhupada says in the Nectar Devotion, he says they're manifesting and unmanifesting in Gokula. And in Goloka Vrindavan, it's mostly the primary ones that are active. Of course, there's also chivalry and comedy. But all of these are coming from Krishna. And in fact, this lila, the word here is lila, because it has to do with the devotee of Krishna, is also related to Krishna. And so one who wants to relish some anger and horror and shock can relish these pastimes. There's a place for everything. We're not saying, we in the Hare Krishna movement do not say that to stop desire or to stop enjoyment or to stop taste. That is not our philosophy. That is the philosophy of the impersonalists. They would read this pastime and say, oh, this is horrible. It is horrible. They'd say, just become peaceful. Everybody should just be Om Shanti. But everything is there in Krishna, and everything is there in the pastimes of Krishna. Of course, Krishna also has some pretty intense pastimes of horror and shock, like when fighting with Jarasandha. He's fighting with Jarasandha, and there's rivers of blood, and the body parts of the people and the body parts of the animals killed in the battle are floating in these rivers of blood, and they're compared to different creatures. And Prabhupada says that cowards don't like this, but that chivalrous fighters get energized. Right? And one of the battles, I think, with Shalva is compared in the Bhagavatam to the playground of Lord Shiva, which, because here Kali, of course, is the wife of Lord Shiva. So this is also a playground for her and her associates, where they're dancing and singing and playing with balls. So this is also there. Our Krishna conscious philosophy doesn't deny any of these rasas. There's the wonder of the universal form. There's a comedy also. Like Narottama Das Thakur sings, Hasya Parihasya Sambhasane, that Krishna with Radharani, with the gopis, they're always laughing and joking. We did one pastime drama in Govardhan at the retreat that was full of comedy. If any of you haven't seen it, it's on radharani.com. So it was full of comedy. Madhu Mangal trying to dance and Krishna dressing up as a lady doctor and Jatila, who never wants Krishna to come in the house, inviting Krishna into the house, right, and washing Krishna's feet and inviting him to stay the night. And so this is all comedy. And so there's also comedy there in Krishna's pastimes. When we say that the devotees are very grave, we mean that they're very serious about their relationship with Krishna. We don't mean that they're just stodgy. You know, we are very grave. We do not feel any emotion. So Prabhupada says we cannot enjoy anything besides these 12 rasas. In a lecture on the nectar devotion in 73, Prabhupada said, if we're sitting on a comfortable chair, that pleasure from the chair is shantaras. So everything has some ras. The point is, am I going to enjoy those rasas in relationship to my own self as the center, with my material senses? Or am I going to enjoy those rasas with Krishna as the center, with my spiritual senses? That's the question. That's really the only question. The question is not, are you going to enjoy or not enjoy? Anandamaya Vyasat. We're pleasure-seeking entities. The scientists have noticed that. They call it the pleasure principle. We're all motivated by pleasure. And all of us like particularly some of these rasas. Some of us like some of them more than others. There are some of us who don't really get any pleasure out of horror and shock. But generally, we get a little pleasure out of all of these. You know, even if you're reading about some catastrophe, there was a tsunami or there was an earthquake, so you may feel a compassion of horror and mercy. Right? And we get some pleasure out of anger. I mean, it's a fact. Anger also gives you some feeling of energy and some feeling of rasa or taste. If it didn't, we wouldn't do it. As Prabhupada says, you cannot enjoy anything besides these 12, and these 12 are motivating everything. So the question is how to turn it to Krishna. I mean, Kali here, who's also called Vaishnavi, she's becoming very angry, and she's relishing that anger. She's enjoying that anger. But her anger is being used for Krishna. She's using her anger in a way that's pleasing Krishna. Krishna's actually very happy that Judd Bharat is being protected. And he's very happy that these dacoits are being killed in this way. It's proper justice. So this is anger properly displayed. I mean, for the devotee, our main anger is exemplified and used in preaching. Frankly, if we don't feel some anger, we're not going to be interested in preaching. I mean, you could also preach out of pride, but that's not very good. But anger is also there when there's love. If you love somebody, sometimes you're going to become angry at them if they're doing something that's harming themselves. Isn't that a fact? Right? So if you saw somebody that you love trying to kill themselves, you wouldn't just say, oh, please don't do that. You would get angry. I don't know if I told this story here before, but when my youngest son was about 8 or 9, he had a friend over, and all of a sudden we couldn't find them. We didn't know where they were. And one of the other kids who was at our house said, oh, they took the boat across the street. We had a little inflatable boat. And across the street there was a river that ended in a waterfall and that fed the water supply for the city. So our son at that point didn't know how to swim. I mean, now he knows how to swim, but at that time he didn't know how to swim. And somehow or other, he'd gone out in this rubber dinghy and this river that had a waterfall. So, you know, we raced across the street and I started yelling at him, get out of there! Paddle the boat to the shore! You know, I was screaming at him. I was angry. I didn't just say, oh, don't do that. That's not very safe. Right? So sometimes love manifests as anger. And Kali here, out of love for Jetta Bharat, and frankly, out of love for her devotees. She wanted to stop their nefarious activities. She wanted to put an end to that. And she's displaying anger out of love for Krishna, whose devotee is being about to be himself decapitated. So we can use anger in preaching. If we're not angry at the fact that people are slaughtering cows and killing babies in the womb and, you know, on the external platform and wasting their lives without any transcendent knowledge, then why should we go out and try to help them? we'll just sit around and say, oh, that's too bad. You know, if we just feel kind of sad about it. But the devotee has anger, not angry at the people as an enemy, but angry that people that they care about are doing something destructive. And we can take pleasure in the horror and the shock of Krishna. Krishna is also doing horrible things, which is one reason why the atheists say there's no God. You know, Krishna is ultimately the one behind the earthquakes and the tsunamis and the scorching heat and the freezing cold and the tornadoes, and that's ultimately Krishna. And the devotee sees that everything is good, that God is all merciful, that God is all kind, and takes pleasure, takes relish, as Krishna does, in all of these different aspects. And that's the only way to get free of relishing the material tastes. You know, if we have some, and I assume that all of us have some, maybe it's very small and maybe subtle, or maybe it's very big and very gross. Maybe some of us have big, gross, bad habits, and some of us maybe have subtle bad habits. But whether you steal cucumbers or diamonds, it doesn't really matter. You're still a criminal. So whatever we're trying, whatever rasa we're trying to enjoy in this world, I mean, if we think about what is it that attracts us in the material world, what is the taste that attracts us in this world to do things separate from Krishna, to try to sneak and have some part of our life that's separate from Krishna, or even some thoughts, you know, some nasty thoughts or some exploitive thoughts, and say, how can I get that taste in Krishna consciousness? Where can I go in Krishna consciousness where I can find that's the original form of that pleasure? Just like it's explained that one who hears the Rasalila from a realized soul loses their interest in material sex life. So in the same way, one who takes pleasure in these pastimes of the Lord and the Lord's devotee, they lose their interest for the perverted and empty and unsatisfying material reflection of the same things. You know, if you have the real thing, why would you want the reflection of the thing? If you have real food, why would you want a picture of food? And our material rasa—it's like that. It's actually all within the mind. It's not something that we're directly experiencing. And Krishna explains this so nicely in the 5th and 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that it's not really me when my senses come in touch with their sense objects, including the mind. The mind is one of the sense objects, one of the senses. I'm not actually having any direct contact. I'm just a witness. And that's one reason why, although we are trying to experience these 12 rasas, we don't feel satisfied. It's not really happening to me. It's just happening to someone with whom I'm identifying and whom I'm observing, like a dream body. And another reason it's not satisfying, of course, it's that it's temporary. Prabhupada says these 12 rasas we enjoy in this world, at the end of this body, that rasa is finished. So I may have a parental relationship with someone, or a conjugal relationship with someone, or a friendly relationship with someone, but after death, that relationship is over. I may not have a relationship with that person again at all, or I may in another life have a different relationship with them. But I can't keep enjoying that rasa, and that's also why it's not satisfying. Dukalayam shashvatam. First of all, it's misery because I can't really enjoy it. It's not me that's enjoying it. I'm just a witness. I'm looking at the enjoyment between my senses and their objects, and thinking that I'm getting some kind of pleasure out of it. Therefore, it's called a drop of water in the desert. And then even if I say, well, it may only be a drop, but at least it's something. No, ashashvatam, it's temporary. You can't even keep your drop. You know, all you have is a drop and you don't get to keep it. And then also because it's self-centered, it's not very satisfying. Just like if you try to rub food into your hands, how much satisfaction will you get? I mean, some of the nutrients will go through your skin, but not much. You know, if you just take baths and soup and don't eat. So maybe it will take you longer to starve to death, but you'll still starve to death. It's just not the way to become satisfied. So the living entity, first of all, trying to satisfy themselves through this artificial machine. You know, it's like putting petrol in your car. It doesn't make you feel full in your own belly. So we're trying to do it through a machine. It's temporary, and I'm not the center. That's not the way in which I enjoy these rasas. There is a way, but it's not that way. It's by satisfying Krishna. So that's what we need to do. We're not trying to stop pleasure, and we're not trying to stop any of these rasas, even the so-called bad ones, like horror. It's not that we say, oh, no, we don't want anything to do with horror. If we didn't, then we'd have to skip these parts of the Bhagavatam. We'd have to skip the whole 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. You know, the soldiers are rushing into Krishna's mouths and he's smashing them in his teeth. Yeah, that's not even vegetarian. Right? So we're not trying to stop it. We're trying to bring it back. And Prabhupada has such a nice quote in Majjha Lila 20, 294 to 98, a lecture that he gave in 66. He said, when the relationship to experience rasa is exchanged between Krishna and the jiva, then that's called lila. That lila is when a relationship is exchanged between Krishna and the jiva for the purpose of tasting rasa. So sometimes we think of lila as a plot. I don't know what a plot is. Like if you write stories or read stories, so a story has a plot, that's what happens. First this happens, then this happens, then this happens. The action that takes place. Also in a narrative, in a story, there are the characters, the people who do the action. There's the theme, there's the message, the point. And there's also the mood. There's the overall, there's the overall mood of the story. So what really makes something lila is that there's this mood of exchange somehow, whether my voice is gone. So Prabhupada says, if you want to experience horrible things, he says this in a lecture in Seattle in 68, he says, if you want to experience horrible things with Krishna, then worship Lord Nrisimhadev, who's also engaged in this horrible, ghastly activity. You know, sometimes non-devotees will see a picture of Nrisimhadev and they just like, how can you worship God like this? You know, we're kind of used to it. We don't think about it very much. But, you know, you see these paintings and Nrisimhadev's wearing intestines. And he's got blood all over his lap and all over the floor, and he's got blood coming out of his nails and blood all over his mane. Right? I think like that. So I know in some temples they've made sure that that kind of painting isn't in a very prominent place. But so everything is there. And therefore we should examine, what is it that I'm trying to enjoy in this world? And instead of just trying to stop it, instead of trying to kill it, find, where can I have that in Krishna? Where can I have that in Krishna? If I like horrible, ghastly things, Prabhupada says, then you go to Nrisimhadev, or you can go to a story about a Kali killing the thieves that wanted to kill Judd Bharat. If you want some nice, sweet friendship, then you go to Krishna in Vrindavan. And everything is there. Just like when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu incarnated, he also showed all of these different forms, didn't he? He appeared also as Varaha. He appeared as Nrisinga. When he appeared as Nrisinga, he was running through the town, roaring at everyone and scaring everyone. So everything's there. That's simply our point, to take everything and turn it to Krishna. Take everything and turn it to Krishna. Take everything and turn it to Krishna. And that is lila. Lila isn't just, what is the story? That's not lila. People think, you know, well, I know the stories. Or they have some, you know, we might have a trivia game. Okay, what demon did Krishna fight with 17 times? Or what demon had a spaceship? And what? That's not really lila. Lila is this exchange of pleasure, this exchange of rasa. And when we are exchanging rasa with Krishna, then even though we are apparently in this world and in this body, then we are going to be in Leela. We are going to be in Krishna's sports. So I'll stop here if there's any questions or comments or additions, subtractions. Yes. Prabhupada said there will also be an ISKCON in the spiritual world. I mean, not like with toilets and not that part of ISKCON. Not the brick buildings and some of the other stuff. Yes. Worshipping the ancestors, you said? Oh, yes, yes. Devotees are so thoughtful. I've never heard anybody ask a question like that before. You get certain questions that people ask over and over and over again. I figured there's about five things that people ask about over and over and over again. I've never heard something like that. It's so lovely. Okay, so you're saying that in one hand, the scriptures are telling us that we're supposed to offer oblations to the ancestors. But on the other hand, using the example of Abhimanyu, you could also use the example of Chitraketu, where the son came back to life, and he was told by Narada and, was it Parvat Muni there? He was told, this is your father and mother. And he said, oh, in what birth were they my father and mother? In which lifetime? So if after death the relationship is broken, then why are we saying that one should worship the ancestors? So I understand several reasons why the children worship the ancestors. First of all, it's one of the motivations for parents trying to have good children. Because when you go to the higher planets, you're living off whatever karmic deeds you've deposited in your good karma account. And when they're used up, you have to leave the heavens. I mean, unless you can do more good karma there, but that doesn't usually happen. Just like when people go to a vacation spot, they don't usually make money there, they just spend money. Right? So you can amass more good karma in heaven. But generally people don't. They just want to enjoy and use up their karma. So they want their children to be putting more money into their account on earth. And that way they won't use up their karma. That's the idea. Just like sometimes a person goes to work in a foreign country and they send money back for the relatives. So that's the concept. And this is an inducement for people to raise pious children. And to have good relationships with their children. Because, you know, if your children don't like you, then they might not perform the ceremonies. Or if you don't raise them nicely, if you just raise them to be bums, then they won't care anymore. Oh, good, dad's dead and gone, let me take his inheritance and enjoy life. But now, actually, all the religions of the world have some provision for this. And it is going on. I mean, among the not sure do the Christians do it, but the Jews definitely do it, and in China they definitely do it, and the Muslims definitely do it. They have some sort of offering that once a year on the anniversary of the person's death, and also I know the Jews also one day a year they do for all of the ancestors, just in case you've forgotten any. Of course, what also tends to happen is after a few generations you're forgotten. Prabhupada gives this as an explanation of why only a certain number of generations before and after you are liberated if you become a devotee. He says, because the liberation takes place due to attachment, you're liberated because you're attached to a devotee. And after a certain number of generations, you don't know that person anymore. Just like most of us don't know our great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers. You know, like I knew my grandparents and I knew one great-grandmother, but I don't know my great-great-grandparents. Most people don't even know the names of their great-great-grandparents, what to speak of having any attachment for them or having any desire to do some good for them. So this idea of pinda, you know, it's only going to last for a few generations, but that's the concept from the point of view of the parents. I think from the point of view of the children, it's remembering that one should be grateful to one's ancestors. That's one of the debts. We're indebted to our family, we're indebted to the demigods, and we're indebted to the sages. And I see it as a way of reminding people that you have to be grateful. You have to be reciprocal, you have to do some sacrifice. So you can do that. I mean, just like Prabhupada said that if you pray for someone who's died, it acts like witnesses in the court. So there's definitely benefit even for praying for someone or offering something to somebody who's in another body. Even if they no longer have any technical relationship with you and they don't remember you, that doesn't matter. Is that all right? Anybody else? Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.